It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We meet the new president of the American Medical Association. Dr. Jesse Ehrenfeld is a Medical College of Wisconsin clinical anesthesiologist, senior associate dean, and professor. You can call in with a question or comment for the nation's largest physicians group, now led by a Wisconsin doctor. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Ehrenfeld, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
Well, lay some groundwork for us. What are your top priorities as the new president of the American Medical Association?
Well, I'll tell you, you know, in America today, in Wisconsin, after 3 really long years of dealing with the pandemic, people are burnt out in a lot of jobs, but especially those of us who work in healthcare. We've had this twindemic, a COVID pandemic and a pandemic of bad information. And, you know, doctors, nurses, we've got a really important job, and that's to keep people healthy. But we've got a healthcare system in crisis. So my term as AMA president, I'm working to help physicians recover from all of this. We launched an effort last year because we know that physicians have just put everything into the nation's response to COVID. And now we've got to shore up our healthcare system. So I'm continuing to help the AMA lead our charge to make sure that we can reform Medicare payments to physicians, improve telehealth access, and reduce stigma around mental health care and burnout. So I'm excited about trying to drive these changes, trying to improve the health for everybody in the U.S., everybody in Wisconsin, particularly those who have been historically marginalized. And I'll tell you, issues of health equity, of LGBTQ health are close to my heart, have long been a focus of my work in medicine, and are an important part of my work in the year ahead.
We're going to talk about that in just a moment, but help us make some connections here. How do things like telehealth or stigma or Medicaid, how do they connect to physician burnout, and how do you go about reducing it through the AMA?
Well, we've got a lot of backseat drivers in medicine today, unfortunately, and it used to just be insurance companies that would make us jump through all sorts of hoops to get things authorized and care that our patients need. Now we've got increasing legislative interference, which is a challenge, administrative hassles, and unfortunately, physician payments from the Medicare federal programs have actually continued to decline. Another proposed 3% cut to physician payments in a time when, as you know, inflation continues to rise. Those things are just driving people to the brink, and unfortunately, it's increasingly challenging to keep the lights on, particularly in small practices and private practices. And that's why we actually just released some data last week around a continued shift in practice ownership across the nation. Physicians continue to be less likely to work in private practice than they were 10 years ago. It's mostly because of these economic, administrative, and regulatory burdens.
In your inaugural speech, you describe American medicine being under threat from legislative overreach. You just mentioned that, worrying about efforts to interfere with patient and physician autonomy. What is wrong with lawmakers setting greater limits on the power of doctors?
Well, unfortunately, you've got people who don't really understand healthcare using political wedge issues to interfere with the practice of medicine. Ultimately, decisions should be between a patient and their physician and their care team. And unfortunately, we continue to see in many states, legislators come in and just decide that we're going to make it illegal for evidence-based appropriate care to occur. This is mostly happening in issues around women's reproductive health, abortion access, but also it's happening increasingly around gender-affirming care. We strongly oppose any state law that allows for discrimination, and we continue to push forward with the simple concept that healthcare decisions ought to be left between a doctor and their physician and their healthcare team.
We're talking with the new president of the American Medical Association, Dr. Jesse Ehrenfeld, anesthesiologist at the Medical College of Wisconsin. You can join in the conversation at any point. The number to call in with a question or comment, 800-642-1234. Turning to your inaugural speech, you talked about your son, Ethan. Ethan, born 10 weeks early and underweight. What do you want people to take away to know about Ethan's time in intensive care?
Well, you know, we have an American healthcare system that is incredibly sophisticated, that can provide life-saving care, but that care is unequal. And, you know, we had access to some of the nation's best doctors, some of the most incredible care. And our son, who was born at 29 weeks, just over 2 pounds.
Wow.
Just went off to summer camp this morning.
Oh, my goodness.
He's gonna have a great day in the pool and doing all the things that you would expect a 4-year-old to do.
Oh.
But unfortunately, there are so many families that just aren't able to access that kind of high quality, sophisticated care, or if they can, it'll bankrupt them. And those inequities in healthcare access are unacceptable. And a big part of our work at the AMA to make sure that everybody in America has access to the same high quality, effective care.
Ethan needed a blood transfusion. You and your husband wanted to donate. How did that unfold?
Well, as you probably know, since the 1980s, there was a ban on the donation of blood by gay men. That came out of the initial part of the AIDS crisis. But as science has changed, as testing for infectious diseases has changed, that policy no longer made sense. It hasn't made sense for decades. And so, for more than 10 years, the AMA has been advocating to eliminate the ban, the wholesale ban on gay men like my husband and I from donating blood. And we were not able to donate blood, obviously, when Ethan was born in 2019. But because of advocacy from the AMA and others, that FDA policy finally just was changed this spring, making it possible for a more appropriate, evidence-based, equitable policy to take effect across the nation.
You are a pioneer as the first openly gay person to serve as president of the American Medical Association. What does taking on this leadership role mean to you?
Well, I tell you, somebody listening today in Wisconsin hearing us is struggling because they happen to be gay or identify as LGBTQ. And I can only hope that the visibility that I bring through my leadership of the AMA, the nation's oldest, largest, most influential physician group, can give that listener some hope, some sense of possibility. Again, I do want to make sure that all patients everywhere can get the healthcare they need, but that's only going to be possible if physicians and patients are able to make decisions themselves without the interference of lawmakers, telling us how to do our jobs and second-guessing the science behind medicine.
You say that there are a range of inequities and injustices in medicine. How could the AMA address these issues, prioritize them, and then make change?
Well, our work to eliminate long-standing health inequities, improve outcomes for populations that have been marginalized, cast aside, requires us to do a number of things. It requires us to address structural racism in healthcare and a healthcare system. It means that we have to make sure that our healthcare workforce, our physicians, have an understanding of what's happening. We've been very concerned about some activities at the Supreme Court. You're probably well aware of the race case that was decided that has put a damper on activities related to affirmative action in healthcare, the Students versus Fair Admission versus Harvard and Students for Fair Admissions versus University of North Carolina that just a few weeks ago have basically pulled away a lot of the opportunities for affirmative action programs to be brought forward in higher education. That impacts medicine. It will limit the ability for diverse students to enter into college and ultimately enter into medical school, and that will harm patients.
How much influence, how much power does the AMA have as a unified voice, as you look at the courts and legislative bodies in Wisconsin and the state and nation? How much power does the AMA have?
All of it. No, we obviously we work at all levels of government. We work in the judicial branch, legislative, and certainly we rely on our state partners. The Wisconsin Medical Society is an incredibly important partner for the AMA and all of our work that we do at the state level. And ultimately, our mission is pretty simple, right? To elevate the art and science of medicine and the betterment of public health. And that means that we have to respect the law. But when we have an ethical obligation to a patient that we can't fulfill because of a problem with the law, we have to advocate for change. And that's why we work so hard across the nation, at the federal level, in the courts, working with the administration to make sure that we have rational policy that allows us to try to elevate the health of all patients.
Medical College of Wisconsin anesthesiologist Jesse Ehrenfeld, newly inducted president of the American Medical Association, the nationwide association of physicians. You can join the conversation at any point. Call in with a question, a comment at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with Medical College of Wisconsin clinical anesthesiologist Jesse Ehrenfeld, newly elected president of the American Medical Association, as we explore his vision for a more inclusive and equitable future for medicine. You can join in along the way, asking a question. You can share a comment. The number to call in is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. During the first 2 years of the COVID pandemic, Pew Research Center found weakening support among Americans for their local hospitals and medical centers. How can doctors rebuild trust with patients in the wake of the pandemic?
You know, a lasting lesson learned from the pandemic is just how quickly medical misinformation, disinformation, bad information, whatever you want to call it, can be spread online and through social media, and the devastation that this leaves behind. This causes consequences for our patients and frankly, for the health of the nation, because people start to lose trust. They lose trust in medical institutions. They lose trust in healthcare professionals, and that hampers our ability to respond in a crisis. So it is critically important that we counter those voices. That's a lot of my work at the AMA, but we have to do that as across the profession to make sure that anybody who's spreading blatantly false health information can be countered. So we appreciate credible media outlets, interviews like this as one way to make sure that science-based medicine health information is disseminated to the public in ways that can be understood and can start to make sure that we keep people moving in the right direction.
Do you see trust issues in your discipline in anesthesiology?
Well, you know, the good news is that most people and their survey on this still trust their doctor. Mm-hmm. But I will tell you, I recently had a patient come in for cardiac surgery who needed a blood transfusion or potentially needed a blood transfusion. And I was talking to the patient pre-op and doing my informed consent. And I got to the subject of a transfusion. And I said, you know, if you need a transfusion, would you be willing to do that? Let me do that for you, because this is cardiac surgery. And the patient said, no, doc, I don't, because, you know, I don't want to get the COVID vaccine. I haven't been vaccinated yet. And I'm afraid that if you give me blood, I'll get vaccinated. That's a bad choice. That is a choice made on misinformation, bad information. We know that vaccines are safe and effective. And unfortunately, that patient is making a poor choice, right, that has potential serious consequences when they're coming in for a major surgical procedure.
How did you respond in the moment?
So I think, like many of my colleagues who have had that kind of conversation over and over and over the last 3 years, you pause and you ask yourself, do you have the energy to have the conversation with the person in front of you? That day I did, and we sat down, we spent about 20 minutes talking about it. And ultimately that patient decided that they still wanted to forego a blood transfusion in that procedure. That's not the decision I would have made for my family or my mom or my dad, but you do all you can.
Let's bring on Jane in Suamico. Jane, hi. What would you like to share?
Yes, good morning. Congratulations, first of all, to the doctor for his new position, and I'm happy to hear the news about his son. I wanted to ask about pay for doctors. I have a brother who was a general practitioner in internal medicine in Green Bay for 32 years, and especially toward the end of his career, he talked about how orthopedic surgeons and certain specialties made four times as much money as someone in internal medicine who was practicing family care, more like family care. And I wondered how those rates of pay are set.
Jane, thank you. Go ahead, Dr. Ehrenfeld.
Yeah, it's a complex issue how payment is set. And there are obviously a lot of factors that go into reimbursement issues. Ultimately, a lot of these decisions are driven by the marketplace, with heavy influence from the federal government and the Medicare program, which is kind of the elephant in the room, because the Medicare payment rates evaluation drives so much of what happens in third-party payment systems, the United Healths, the Aetnas, the Cignas of the world. We understand that obviously there are challenges when you have particularly primary care specialists, internists, family doctors, pediatricians, who aren't receiving levels of payment that allow their practices to be thriving and sustainable. And that's why we continue to advocate for more support for the Medicaid program, more support for primary care. But ultimately, unfortunately, we've seen a freeze in the rise of physician payments. And that's why we continue to advocate for statutory updates for at least inflation adjustments that the federal government hasn't been providing.
Is this leading also to workforce issues as the emerging doctors decide what type of medicine they will practice?
Well, we don't have the workforce that we need today, and we certainly are not going to have the workforce that we need tomorrow. And workforce expansion is a key priority for the AMA. We've brought a lot more medical schools online in the last 15 years, but we haven't expanded what's the next step, which is our residency programs, our graduate medical education opportunities. So we've got actually not more U.S. physicians who graduate, sorry, U.S. students who graduate from medical schools than we have training spots. And so we now have these sort of unmatched students who actually have no place to train. And that's a problem that actually there's some pretty easy solutions to that we continue to advocate for both at the state and the federal level. And there has been some movement here in Wisconsin for some expansion for these graduate medical education training spots. But we need more of that both here in Wisconsin and across the nation.
Talking with Dr. Jesse Ehrenfeld, anesthesiologist at Medical College of Wisconsin and new president of the American Medical Association. Let's bring in Alyssa in Sparta. Alyssa, hi.
Good morning. Again, I want to just congratulate you, doctor, on your promotion. My question, I am a social worker in geriatric palliative care, and we are seeing an intense lack of services for long-term care facilities and in-home services. And I'm very fearful as what the next 10 years are going to amount to for that population. And wondering if you could kind of weigh in on your vision and kind of what we can do to really make this issue come to the forefront, because I think it's going to be pretty catastrophic unless there are some pretty significant changes made.
Thank you, Alyssa. Dr. Ehrenfeld, go ahead.
You know, you raise a really important question. I tell you, my parents are in their 70s. My in-laws are in their 70s. My dad's struggling with some health issues, starting to need some of those kinds of services that you're describing, and they're really hard to get. And we know that there are going to be tremendous challenges in meeting those needs for seniors across the nation and here in Wisconsin if we don't do something. Unfortunately, we just do not have the workforce. We don't have the training pathways. We don't have the reimbursement mechanisms to make all of these things come together. And so those are points that we continue to join with our partners across all of healthcare to try to advocate to make sure that the services are there when our parents and our patients need them.
So really, you look to collaborations in order to bridge these gaps in caring for the elderly and people at end of life.
We won't solve these problems on our own, and we work with obviously all of healthcare to make sure that we try to advocate for the best rational policy to make sure that we have the health workforce writ large to meet the needs of all patients.
Mike in Franklin now. Mike, go ahead.
Well, good morning. I'm actually going to change what I was going to talk about. Originally, it was just going to have to do with education, but you've already kind of talked about that. One thing that my wife and I have experienced when our kids were younger was there was always some community health nurse that was around where our kids could go and get in their vaccinations. We hear about the Black community that relies very strongly on doulas to support young mothers as they go through their pregnancy and afterwards. And I know that there have been situations where there have been county-supported programs for all sorts of different healthcare solutions. What types of things might we be able to do to integrate some of those things, bring them back, or come up with more creative solutions to reach those numbers that we need to have for providing quality healthcare for?
Thank you, Mike. Go ahead, Dr. Ehrenfeld.
Sure. So, you know, I think the best case scenario is that every American has access to their own physician, but we know that that's not the reality. And we know that so many people in so many communities rely on the public health system, the public health infrastructure, community public health nurses, other individuals, like you said, doulas, for critical services that can help keep them healthy. All of those professionals are under stress under attack, and we continue to see a reduction in support for a lot of those kinds of programs. And unfortunately, another challenge that we still have not gotten past because of the pandemic is that so many people have left the public health profession because of so many of the challenges and the stress. And I know here in Wisconsin, because I have a lot of connectivity to folks in the public health community, people have left
quickly.
Those jobs and they haven't come back.
Dr. Jesse Ehrenfeld, newly elected president of the American Medical Association. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The American Medical Association votes to adopt a new policy encouraging physicians not to rely only on body mass index to gauge a person's risk for obesity-related health conditions. We discuss the new guidelines, hear from you about calculating body fat. Call in with a question or comment, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Fatima Cody Stanford is an associate professor of medicine and pediatrics at Harvard Medical School, a specialist in obesity medicine at Mass General Hospital in Boston. Dr. Stanford, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Just want to correct my name is Dr. Fatima Cody
Stanford. Oh, Fatima.
Stanford.
Thank
yes,
you so
no
much
worries.
For that correction. Appreciate it. How could the American Medical Association's new guidance on body mass index affect the work of physicians and their care for patients?
Well, first of all, I want to applaud the American Medical Association for taking this very much needed and long overdue move to recognize that body mass index is never intended to be a measure of health, yet we've utilized it in medicine for so long to determine what one's weight status is. And so I'm happy to see the shift away from focusing on one number that does not apply broadly across the full population to determine health status, particularly as we get into issues such as overweight and obesity.
So how is body mass index being used incorrectly in healthcare settings or in other spaces for that matter?
Absolutely. So body mass index, for those of you who are listening, is a measure of height and weight that is used to determine one's weight status and health status. And I'll just take you through how we've utilized it for the adult population over time. So a person that has a body mass index less than 18 and a half is considered to have underweight. And a person that has a BMI between 18.5 and 24.9 is considered to have a healthy weight status or a normal weight status by BMI criteria. We get into those that have overweight when we get into a BMI of 25 to 29.9. And then we get into those that have obesity when we cross that threshold of a BMI of 30. And then there's three classes of obesity. Class one, which is considered mild obesity, a BMI of 30 to 34.9. Moderate obesity or class two obesity, which is a BMI of 35 to 39.9. And then those with severe obesity, which is a BMI greater than or equal to 40. The issue with this measure is that this is not applicable across the population. It doesn't really give us a sense of whether or not one's weight actually correlates with one's health. And what do I mean by that? For example, if a patient is admitted to the hospital and they are having a heart failure exacerbation, which means they usually have an overburden of fluid in their body, what happens is we bring them into the hospital and we pull that fluid off of them. We can pull sometimes 15, 20 pounds of fluid off to allow their heart to pump and function normally. Well, they've lost 20 pounds in a hospital admission, but did their health really change? Are they likely going to be back in the hospital with another heart failure exacerbation? Indeed, the case is true. But if you were to look at their BMI, it would have improved quite drastically. So if we were to equate that with their health, we would be completely wrong. Was what we've done. And also these measures were not based in medicine or science. They were initially developed by a statistician in the 1800s to determine what normal body weight was for Belgium white male soldiers in the 1800s. And in the 1900s, the actuarial tables, particularly the New York Life Insurance Company, sought to determine what was considered to be normal weight status for insurability of white men and women for life insurance. Notice I didn't say anything about us in medicine and hospitals, but we then use that to determine weight status and determine health based upon those measures.
You did say white men and women, white Belgium soldiers. What about racist exclusion here in body mass index?
Absolutely. So that is a major part of the issue. And I was very strategic in using these modifiers when I did indicate this. So when these BMI measures were developed, they did not look at racial ethnic minority populations like myself. I am a Black woman who's a descendant of the enslaved in this country. I was not included in the development of BMI metrics as we use them today. Additionally, populations that are largely from Asia, which usually have lower body mass index cutoffs to correlate with health standards, meaning at lower BMI cutoffs, they're known to have higher rates of issues like type 2 diabetes or non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, they weren't taken into account. And so when we look at the heterogeneity of our population, right, this melting pot that is the United States, for example, this BMI metric does not apply well across our diverse patient population.
We're talking about the body mass index and where it goes from here. Dr. Fatima Cody Stanford, an associate professor of medicine and pediatrics at Harvard Medical School, specialist in obesity medicine at Mass General Hospital, our guide. You can call in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Should the body mass index remain a measurement that is used for some purposes in healthcare? Is there still some use for it?
Yeah, so I really think that BMI is a great screening tool, but not a diagnostic tool. And let me explain the difference between screening and diagnosis. So if I want to screen a large population of people, let's say I want to look at 10,000 people and determine who might be more at risk for something, you could say, okay, well, this BMI might put you at greater risk. But I really need to do a deeper dive to get to the true answer, which means I need to look at things like their cholesterol values. I need to look at their blood sugar. I need to look at their liver function tests, their insulin numbers, to determine whether or not the weight metric, this BMI, really corresponds to their health. There are some people that can have higher body mass index and have all of those parameters that we just talked about, like cholesterol, blood sugar, et cetera, all within normal range. And then there are other people that can have a body mass index that is in quote unquote the normal range and have a lot of metabolic disease. And so I really need to just use that to screen to help me take a deeper dive to look at the individual in front of me and then determine if there is something that I need to address with the individual.
If I do have a BMI that is greater than 30, can I still be healthy?
Absolutely. I definitely have patients that have BMIs that are greater than 30 that are much healthier than individuals that have BMIs of 22 or 23. Hmm. You know, it's about looking at that full picture of the person. And then leanness doesn't always equal health, right? Some, you know, how people achieve leanness may be sometimes deleterious. Maybe they use substances to achieve leanness. Maybe they, you know, have a long history of cigarette smoking or alcoholism or whatever it might be to get them into this leaner body state. Unfortunately, we as a population, we decide one's value or worth based upon how they look. When they're walking down the street, if we see someone that carries excess adipose, and adipose is just a fancy word for fat, adipose is an organ, we assume that they're lazy, passive, undisciplined, careless, they didn't work out, they eat horribly. And then we see a lean person walking down the street and we assume that they just ran a marathon yesterday and that they eat, you know, leafy greens and vegetables all day, every day. And so these assumptions that come with our biases really form and shape our opinions about the health of individuals that may have a body mass index that's higher, that may actually be healthier than those that are leaner and vice versa. So I think that we need to check our biases at the door and recognize that we have to look beneath the skin surface to do a deeper dive to determine whether someone's weight status is actually corresponding with poor health status.
Do you think these biases infiltrate the clinical setting when the patient is having that one-on-one conversation with their provider?
Absolutely. I wish I could say the answer is no, but absolutely, with no hesitation, these biases infiltrate in our care as physicians, nurse practitioners, physician's assistants, physical therapists, and the list goes on. I have heard countless stories from my patients where they've gone in to see their doctor, and their doctor's like, well, you know, you need to just eat less and exercise more. And they try to explain what their regimen has been, what they, how they've been really careful about what they've been eating and exercising, and they're just discounted. Mm-hmm. I have a patient that came into me as a new patient just a month and a half ago at 87 years old. She's been told by her orthopedic surgeon that she needs to lose another 50 pounds for her to get a knee replacement. So here you have an 87-year-old woman coming in to see me. She needs to lose another 50 pounds, which implies that she had lost weight, obviously, before they'll even consider making sure she has relief of the knee pain that she's had for the last 7 years. And so it's these biases that really infiltrate and make it such that we provide, I think, lesser care to those that have larger body types, those that do have obesity, those that do struggle with this disease. And I think it's really unacceptable.
What is the role of the American Medical Association here? How could it change how patients with obesity are treated? What influence could it have?
You know, I think that with the AMA being the largest body representing physicians in the United States, they represent all subspecialties, every state is captured. We have, that means a large body of individuals that really represent diverse perspectives coming together and saying using BMI as a solo metric is no longer acceptable. One of the things that they mentioned in their most recent deliberations is using other metrics to correspond with body mass index, things like waist circumference, which is a really simple thing that we can utilize to determine whether or not we're carrying too much weight in our midsection. And when we carry too much weight in our midsection, Kate, that leads to poor metabolic health, things like heart disease, type 2 diabetes, fatty liver, all of these things that can really shorten our life expectancy. So all they're saying is, okay, we can use this to screen, but let's use some additional tools to diagnose and see what's going on beyond just what we're seeing in front of us. And I think this will hopefully begin to shift the narrative by just not judging a book by its cover, which is what we tend to do when we see someone with excess body weight coming into our offices.
Or you see it as a failure of willpower. I mean, what is wrong about seeing obesity as a failure of willpower?
Well, it's not a failure of willpower. It's just that's inherently wrong. How we've been selling this messaging about obesity is wrong. Back in 2013, the American Medical Association voted to declare obesity as a chronic disease. And what we do know is that it's a chronic relapsing disease. It's one that often people might deal with over the course of their life. There's actual physiology that's going on in the brain and the gut that governs the weight that someone carries. Last night, I was at dinner with a set of friends that are visiting here in Boston for the American Society of Nutrition meeting. And I was with some colleagues from Italy. One of the colleagues, he can eat whatever he wants. He can eat 10 donuts at a time. He can do whatever. And if you look at his body habits, he's quite lean. So the presumption would be that he never eats like that, but he does this on a daily basis. So his body is signaling in such a way that he doesn't store much of his adipose, which is great for him. And so when you look at him, you don't make these negative assumptions. Now, let's say his body reflected what his intake actually is. He would likely be 3 times his size. And then we would assume all of these negative things that we don't assume by looking at him because he carries such a lean body habitus. Hmm. This idea of willpower is really false and grossly misguided. We have ultra marathoners. We have triathletes that carry excess body weight. It's not a matter of them not having willpower. They're able to do more than most of us are able to do in our physical realm, and they're able to support that with great health and nutrition. Their body has just decided to store more of that adipose tissue. And so there's dysfunction in their physiology that we do have the ability to correct if we treat it like the chronic disease that it is.
Obesity medicine specialist Dr. Fatima Cody Stanford, a member of the USDA's 2025 Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee with reaction on a new policy from the American Medical Association on body mass index. Call in with your question, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. An obesity medicine physician reacts to a new policy from the American Medical Association urging doctors to shift away from the body mass index as a critical health measurement, saying the index can be inaccurate or misleading. Share what you think of the new policy. Call in with a question at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Harvard Medical School physician Dr. Fatima Cody Stanford is here. Let's take a call now. Mark in Richland Center. Mark, hi. What would you like to share?
Good morning. A doctor named Robert Lustig says that 40% of our population has non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And the question is, would the BMI ever tell us that? Probably not, because 40% of our population isn't going to, well, the BMI won't even measure that anyways. And yet it's a serious medical problem that needs to be found out by other means.
Mark, thank you. Dr. Stanford, what can you tell us there?
Absolutely. Well, I think that the callers really touched or kind of hit the nail on the head. You know, the BMI doesn't tell us, you know, anything about fatty liver disease. We have no idea what a person's liver fat content is just by looking at the BMI metric. We do need to look at first the liver function test to give us a sense of whether we need to do a deeper dive and do imaging like ultrasound and different scans that we can use to pick up whether a person has non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And this is exactly the reason why BMI by itself is just not a sufficient tool. We do have to be looking to determine what one's health status is. And if a patient has fatty liver disease, that's an indicator of poor health. But we would not pick that up but just looking at the BMI. Someone can be very lean and have really robust fatty liver disease, getting towards what we call non-alcoholic steatohepatitis, which is really advanced and unfortunately often irreversible liver disease. But we have to do a deep dive to get to that. And I completely agree that we need to go beyond BMI to find out these issues and really address these issues. Fatty liver disease is becoming the number one reason for liver transplants here in the United States. But if we don't investigate it, then we get all the way down to the need for a new liver, which is exactly the problem with BMI as a solo metric. So thank you so much, caller, for giving that information.
Are there better measurements than BMI to assess my health risks? What should I be looking toward then, if not BMI?
Well, like I said, I think BMI is a great screening tool, but I think we can use things like waist circumference just to do a quick, crude measure. So what I would say to my patients is to take a tape measure and measure on the inches side at the umbilicus, and that's a fancy word for belly button. Our target for men is a waist circumference less than 40 inches. And for my men listening, this is not your waist size in terms of your pants. A lot of men will say, oh, I wear a 40 waist, but they wear their pants below their true waist. So their waist may actually be 54 inches. And so we need to look at that. For women, our number is less than 35 inches. Now, these numbers do differ for certain populations. For those of Asian descent, the numbers can be lower. For example, we talked about that higher risk of metabolic disease, including fatty liver disease and type 2 diabetes for those that are of Asian descent. And then I also recognize the heterogeneity of the Asian population. We often just loop the Asian populations all together or lump them all together as if they're all the same. But there's heterogeneity in Chinese versus Indian versus Pakistani, et cetera. And these numbers don't always capture these nuances. So like I said, it's important to look at the individual, use these measures to get a deeper dive. If you want to be more advanced, you can use things like DEXA scans. These become very expensive and are hard to do on the population as a whole. And so that's why using something as simple as waist circumference, bioimpedance, these things that are cheaper to use are better metrics.
Let's go to Paula now in La Crosse. Paula, go ahead. Hi.
Oh, hi. Good morning. I just wanted to comment. I recently retired from 35 years as a clinical dietitian, and I used to always tell my patients a number on a scale does not tell us really a lot of times how healthy and or unhealthy we are. And I just found so many things go into why people eat what they choose to eat. It's so multifactorial. I saw a lot of people with undiagnosed obstructive sleep apnea, which really plays havoc on your metabolism, what you eat, and even, you know, morbidly obese, very severe obese women, the whole mental health aspect of trauma that may have happened when women and or men are at a young age. So such a multifactorial facet of what goes into people's eating habits.
Paula, thank you. The number on the scale doesn't begin to tell the whole story, Dr. Stanford.
Absolutely. I'm happy, Paula, you know, this is one of my dietetic colleagues that you've called in. I completely agree. You know, we use this number to really govern how we think about ourselves, whether we're doing things that may not be great. I think one of the things she mentioned is people may choose to eat things that are unhealthy or choose things that are just allowing them to navigate stress. I mean, it is multifactorial. And I think that word was the key word that she used. And I completely agree with her. The number is just one metric and it doesn't give us the full story. This is why I never, ever, much to the dismay of my patients, give them a target weight, because that weight does not tell me their health. I'm trying to get them to the happiest, healthiest weight for them. And I have no idea what that number is. It is not usually what the BMI scale tells me. And so we're searching for health, not a size or, you know, a number on the scale. And I really appreciate, Paula, your comment today.
Stepping back for just a moment in our last minute together. So Kaiser Family Foundation study found 84% of large employers offered health benefits like a workforce wellness program based on BMI, body mass index. What do you make of employers using this for wellness benefits?
You know, I think this is problematic. I've actually written a paper about this with one of my colleagues, Theodore Kyle, who is a major activist for patients that have obesity. And we feel that these employer benefits actually fall short of understanding health. And so that you can't use BMI and striving towards a certain BMI as a tool to help your employees. You really have to be more comprehensive. I know that requires more work, but if it requires more work to get your population healthier, I think we need to put in more work. And I appreciate that employers are trying to use wellness programs, but let's not use arbitrary numbers to dictate one's response to these wellness programs. They really need to be more comprehensive and look at the whole person.
Dr. Stanford, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a delight to be here this morning.
Dr. Fatima Cody Stanford, Associate Professor of Medicine and Pediatrics at Harvard Medical School and Obesity Medicine Specialist. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.